We check in with friend of downtown, writer, Zulu warrior, Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Mr. Gimble?
We are here waiting apparently on some rain. It sounds like you're in the same boat.
Yes, the skies are about to open, and it is looking pretty Macbethian outside.
You got your monument work in already today?
No, I've been alone since my day of record-setting triumph on Sunday. I haven't done anything except walk 3 miles over to Charlestown yesterday, but no, I've been largely stationary today, just riding away.
Well, yeah, you're a man on a mission. You got a lot of things to do, but we're going to break you away from that work for a moment to talk about a couple of things, starting with friends. And I missed this. I assume that the recent kerfuffle was because of the 25th anniversary of the series?
Yes. I find that oftentimes in life these days, it is best when one misses things. So I envy you that. And I should take a more active role in my own ability to miss things rather than staring at things that I read so often that then lodge in my mind. But yes, I think it must have been the 25th anniversary. And Seinfeld has its anniversary, and anniversaries galore. And also Friends is on Netflix. And my little friend, Emma, tells me that many of her friends are Friends watchers. I guess it's big among her age group, that crowd. So a number of things, a confluence of Friends-related things, put it into the news. And somebody whose entire existence is writing pieces that are largely listicles for which they are never paid, that run on the site, whose name I've since forgotten, wrote some piece that trended on Twitter saying that Friends, as will shortly be the case with water and oxygen, is bad for you now. Very bad. Evil.
And it's 'cause all them white people, right?
It is all them white people. And you know what's interesting is you're out in life and you meet the friends you're fortunate enough to make, right?
Right.
But nobody says, it'd be pretty racist if you're sitting there. I'm sitting there with my friend Hardware John. You know him from the email chain. Or
yes.
Norberg. And I said, you know what? You're too white, dude. I need to get some black people. I am targeting black people for my friendship group. Do you know where I can find some? That is awfully racist. And the idea that this show is racist because four or five, six, whatever the number is, it's six, right? White friends are friends. That's how you meet the people you meet when you're a roommate at college, right? And then you meet their sister, and then that person works with someone that you think is cool. That's just how it works out. And I've noticed that a lot of times when people work this race angle, if you look them up afterwards, and I don't recommend doing it because it's maddening, but if you do it, you'll find this trail of breadcrumbs. They often come from an all-white town, and everyone in their photos on social media, and they're rampant on social media, people like this, everybody's white. And again, that can just be circumstantial, but at the same time, I doubt very much that these people are hunkering down with the recordings of Memphis Mini to see what that was all about, or reading female Victorian ghost story writers, because they don't care. It's all a pose. It's this thing that was stuck in front of their face that allowed them to pretend to be a good person without having to do a single good person-related thing. And that's what people are, sadly, not as many as we're led to believe, but a number of people are drawn to something like that right now. And Friends, then we ask these questions about how is it aged? Has it held up well? It wasn't supposed to hold up as anything. Now, you love the Twilight Zone, for instance, but Rod Serling, he would go on these lecture tours in the early 1970s at college campuses, and he would bemoan things within his own series because he never thought people would watch it again.
Right.
Now, Doctor Who was wiped from the BBC's records, all those things. When you hear things like the Beatles BBC sessions, you hear it because British school children taped it off the air, not because we were saving this for posterity. Now, Friends was obviously going to be saved, but it was just this situational comedy that was the 8 o'clock version of a bag of Doritos.
And to me, and I watched Friends, I thought the first season was very good, and then it sort of coasted from that point on. If I was going to be troubled by anything in that series, it would be the fact that every possible combination seemed to hook up among those six except Chandler and Joey, and you know, maybe they didn't talk about it.
People romantically inbreed, though, that somebody will know somebody from afar and they'll tell you they don't like them, and you believe that. But then they end up in the same peer group for whatever reason. That's what people do, because people lack purpose and they're lazy. And they are, as I have been the last couple of days, stationary. They don't ambulate in terms of searching for new life experiences. I find friends awfully, awfully benign. It is ideal to have on to treat as we might treat something like the end of the Red Sox season now. A companion in the room.
Yes.
Is just a sort of television wallpaper. And the people who go after friends, they, of course, elevate things like Seinfeld. Now, I understand why Seinfeld is canonized right now in this age, because to me, it is the television version of a Twitter discussion feed. It's toxic. It's people who are allowed to live their lives as basically nasty comments in human form, ripping on everybody. It has the holier-than-thou tone. And when you read through Twitter, and it's just a gutter. It's just dregs. Those same people, though, who are conducting themselves that way on Twitter, they're holding the door open for you at the Starbucks. But I feel like Seinfeld gives that inner voice that we know not to let out an actual official sanctioned voice, whereas Friends is harmless. It's how you doing, and Ross liking dinosaurs, and Rachel using the word so too often. It's harmless, utterly benign.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's shift gears and discuss one of our favorite topics, Orson Welles and his dislike, lack of respect, I guess we could say, for a lot of fairly legendary directors out there.
Yes, I love this. And somebody put together a compendium of Welles. I'm not going to say trashing people, because I think he was saying the truth. I don't disagree with many of the people that he brings up. We have talked about in the past, so we don't really have to linger on them too much, but he did not like Searchers, The Searchers by John Ford, even though he was a huge John Ford guy, screening Stagecoach 100 times before he made Citizen Kane. And he rips on Hitchcock a lot and Hitchcock's Vertigo. So not like family plot, not late period Hitchcock, although he does go after that. But he absolutely eviscerates Woody Allen, and it's hilarious. He says, I don't like that kind of man physically. I love being able to say, I do not like you physically. I like that era because we are human and we are allowed to be that way. Now, because we don't like someone physically, we can't not hire them or something like that. We have to evaluate them on their merits. But he's talking about the kind of person in Woody Allen who's nebbish, and yet at the same time, arrogant. And that, to me, because that's the whole of publishing, is the worst kind of combo you can have in a person, because they're always going to be gunning for you, but in that cowardly way behind your back. And I feel like Woody Allen's films are a cinematic version of that. So he couldn't stand someone of that ilk. He did not like the Godfather pictures, which I don't like either. It looks to me like somebody smeared fish paste over the lens and tried to get it as dark as possible and shot these fairy tales, in essence, about a kind of person who never actually existed in that way. So I like that he speaks candidly, and even when you disagree with him, he raises interesting points. It never bothers me when someone honestly believes. I had an editor, for instance, at the magazine that has since shuttered because publishing is writing itself right out of the margins of culture. But he could not stand the Beatles. And it wasn't just the Beatles. He thought Charlie Parker was a laughing embarrassment. I enjoyed knowing this from this guy because he was a smart guy. And I feel like he took a wrong turn or two with these judgments. But it's interesting. It's so much more interesting, and when you hear somebody's reasons, than somebody who sends someone like me death threats because I posited that maybe Help was close to the Beatles' weakest album. Well, you just have to do the pom-poms and the cheerleading and hooray for John, Paul, Ringo, George. I find that imbecilic. It's draining to listen to people speak that way as though they're maintaining the dignity of their nostalgia-based obsession. Let things be things. Let us have dialogue. Let us go back and forth. Because when you think that, oh, you know what, Paul McCartney was nowhere near as good at melody as people think, I don't agree. But I'll hear yesterday and I'll think, yeah, it's interesting that he was able to hear this and I hear this other thing.
Let's move on from there to a film that you had a chance to see on the big screen over the weekend, Blow Up, which I have not seen in quite a while. How did it hold up?
I haven't seen it in a while either. And Antonioni is a director that Wells trashed in his quotes, where he essentially says that he is a atmospheric director for fashion commercials. And I understand why he thinks that. If you've seen some of the artier European pictures, they definitely, La Ventura, linger on and on and on and on. And Blow Up, I feel, is a perfect gateway into this director's oeuvre. It was an English film, and it is a locked room mystery, in a sense, because you have a photographer, and you'll recognize this conceit from later on with John Travolta, except he's dealing with sound. You have a photographer who takes a picture in the park, and he thinks, and he actually has, that he's discovered a murder. And all of these other things that are going on at the same time in the film, there are more than a few snatches right out of Hitchcock's Vertigo. And it becomes this wondering, this sort of epiphany about how we, a dawning epiphany on how we process the world in front of us. And I was writing today, for instance, about a guy named Seabury Quinn, and he wrote a book called Roads, and he wrote it for Arkham House, and it's an origin story for Santa Claus. And so I was ended up writing about how you have all of this fiction out there that's so-called psychological realism, and all it is ever about is a professor who's getting divorced from his wife and wants his kid to go to Yale because he went there instead of Harvard. And that's exactly what it is. There's not more to it than that. But when you have weird fiction, and this is a form of weird fiction, it opens up ways to see the world that suggest to us that what we think we're seeing is not at all how reality is. And that's what this film does, and that's what we watch transpire for this photographer. And there's a great scene that involves a favorite band of mine, the Yardbirds, and it's right out of the Vertigo playbook, where he is in this alley and he goes into the back door and he ends up in this club and he doesn't mean to go into that. You see the exact same thing with Scotty when he believes he's recognized this woman in the Hitchcock film. And the Yardbirds are miming Stroll On, which is a remake for contractual reasons of The Train Kept A-Rollin'. And it's one of only three songs by the Yardbirds to feature Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page on co-lead guitars. And Antonioni wanted The Who, and The Who said, no, we're not going to do this, because he wanted them to smash their instruments. And that's what Jeff Beck does with a prop on the big screen that doesn't look anything at all, really, like an authentic guitar. And again, though, it's just this hothouse atmosphere and a very cool, chilled out, leisurely paced film that has these pockets of intensity that you wouldn't expect, but that's how it goes with life and how it goes here.
And for the Yardbirds, you pointed out in our communication, it was almost the end of the line for them, just one album left to go after that appearance.
They're quite close to the end, certainly at this point. And the Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page dream dual guitar lineup was not going to last. In fact, it's surprising that they were able, he got them at exactly the right time. It was only like a few months that they had that set up. And again, though, it comes down to this idea of what we're told and what becomes accepted wisdom that we leave unchallenged. So they had one album left with Jimmy Page, and that became the record Little Games. Little Games was produced, wasn't that long after this, by Mickey Most. And Mickey Most was the guy that people went to for a very pop-oriented sound. He worked with Herman's Hermits, bands of that You've Got a Lovely Daughter sort of ilk. And you hear these and read these reviews, even now, of Little Games as this Bubblegum Confectionery by the once great Yardbirds. If you listen to it, it's one of Jimmy Page's finest moments across the expanse of an album. It's tough, it's bluesy, and the pop that's on it is blues-inflected. And it holds up really well. There's even an Agatha Christie vibe at some points. It's very English. And it's interesting, though, I'm just watching this film, and I'm seeing Jeff Beck smash his guitar, and it made me think, I want to smash all of these lazy assumptions and these not even half-truths, these never-were-truths that we just buy into because we leave so much unchallenged, often now because we're worried about hurting somebody's feelings. But we end up shortchanging ourselves. And in the film Blow Up, the photographer shortchanges himself because he doesn't go back to this park to really get to the bottom of this crime where this corpse is. He delays, he prevaricates, and he goes to this party and he wants a witness who's stoned out of his mind to go with him, and the body is removed. And the takeaway there is, Suze, you're losing on life that you need to roll up the sleeves, get in there, get after it. And whether that's Blow Up, whether that's listening to a Yardbirds album again that's been slagged off, or sitting down with some Ross and some Rachel, you need to get back to those things, I think.
Colin Fleming, covering lots of ground as always and bringing it all back around to home like he does and nobody else does in radio. Thank you, Colin. We'll see you next week.
Sounds good, my friend.